and welcome to Parent Talk Live Special Edition, Safe Medication Use. I am your host, Dr. Susan Gardner. Parent Talk Live Special Edition is sponsored by Forest of the Rain Productions in partnership with the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy, located in Charleston, West Virginia. The mission of Forest of the Rain Productions is to expand the voices of seldom heard in education, fair housing, parental family engagement, academic research, the business of education, and civic involvement. The University of Charleston School of Pharmacy offers its student pharmacists a technology-infused, dynamic, and rigorous curriculum that prepares graduates to practice in today's rapidly changing healthcare environment. Our mission is to prepare pharmacists who will provide comprehensive patient care, to advance the profession through research and advocacy, and to serve the community as leaders in rural health. Tonight is our fifth of six episodes of Parent Talk Live Special Edition, Safe Medication Use. Parent Talk Live Special Edition, Safe Medication Use is an interactive discussion, and our listeners are welcome to join the conversation at any time. You can join us by dialing 563-999-3780 and pressing the number 1. That lets us know that you have a question or comment in queue. You can also follow the discussion along with us via Twitter at @ANaturalBridge or at @UCSOP, and we are using the hashtags SYFChallenge and hashtag IWillTakeMyMeds. Tonight we are discussing the United States Drug Enforcement Agency's 360 Strategy and Initiative, and tonight's guests include Assistant Special Agent in Charge, Mr. David Gourley, along with two student pharmacists, Victoria Olole and Amy Bateman. Again, tonight we're discussing the United States Drug Enforcement Agency's 360 Strategy and Initiative. And that initiative or strategy actually is in response to the heroin and prescription opioid pill crisis in the United States. The 360 strategy takes an innovative three-prong approach to combating heroin and opioid abuse through, first, coordinated law enforcement actions against drug cartels and heroin traffickers in specific communities. Next, diversion control enforcement actions against DEA registrants operating outside the law, and long-term engagement with pharmaceutical drug manufacturers, wholesalers, pharmacies, and practitioners. And finally, community outreach through local partnerships that empower communities to take back affected neighborhoods after enforcement actions and prevent the same problems from cropping up again. The DEA rolled out the 360 strategy in November of 2015 in Pittsburgh together with the U.S. Attorney and state and local partners. Since that time, DEA has deployed the strategy in other pilot cities and is using the three-pronged approach in all DEA field divisions. On February 15th of 2017, the DEA announced that the cities of Charleston and Huntington and the surrounding tri-county areas near West Virginia would be the next region to be a part of a comprehensive law enforcement and prevention initiative, the 360 strategy. This program is designed to help cities and surrounding regions deal with the heroin and prescription drug abuse epidemic and the violent crime associated with it. The 360 strategy focuses on integrating, again, law enforcement, diversion control, education and prevention with community outreach. And the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy is very pleased to be a part of the initiative here in West Virginia. Our first guest is Assistant Special Agent in Charge David Gourley, and he has quite a lengthy bio, so I'm going to do my best to give it its due respect, and just have been very thrilled to be working with David, number one, and the students who will be speaking with you tonight. I've also had the opportunity to meet with him and engage with some of the 360 conversations that we're having here in Charleston, West Virginia. David Gourley graduated from Georgetown College in May of 1990 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in Marketing and Finance. He began his law enforcement career in 1992 as a deputy sheriff with the McCracken County Sheriff's Office in Kentucky. Gourley started his duty with the DEA in 1997, and upon graduation from basic agent training, he was assigned to the Chicago Division Office, where he remained until February of 2002, working in the General Enforcement Group, a money laundering group, and on MET. From February 2002 to August of 2006, Assistant Special Agent in Charge Gourley was assigned to the Carbondale, Illinois post of duty, and he was promoted to Supervisory Special Agent in August of 2006. He led the CAPE, a Missouri resident office of the Carbondale, Illinois post of duty until September of 2012. And at that time, he was reassigned to the Office of Investigative Technology as a staff coordinator in the technology working group. In December of 2013, he became the unit chief for a global telecom intercept unit. And in April of 2016, he was transferred here to Charleston, West Virginia, to the district office to become the group supervisor of the tactical diversion squad. In June of 2016, he was made the acting resident in charge for the Charleston district office following the retirement of the resident agent in charge. And in December 2016, just a little bit ago, actually, the Charleston district office was approved for an assistant special agent in charge position, and David was chosen. He is responsible for managing the counter-drug strategy and operations for the entire state of West Virginia. He provides command and control to one of the HIDTA task force groups, three enforcement groups, two tactical diversion squads, and two posts of duties. So we're very, very fortunate that he has taken some time out of his very busy schedule to be with us here this evening. And so I would like to welcome Assistant Special Agent in Charge Gourley to the show. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Dr. Gardner. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show and talk to your listeners.
We're just so thrilled to have you and to have someone actually from the DEA here to talk with us about the program. It's just so important to get the word out because even though, of course, Charleston is one of your areas that you all are focusing on, this is a pervasive problem throughout the entire country. So it's definitely an important topic. Can you tell... Yeah, definitely. Can you tell our listeners a little more about the DEA 360 strategy and what the goals of the nationwide initiative are?
Like you discussed earlier, there's three components that are involved in the 360 strategy, one being coordination of law enforcement, the second being diversion control enforcement and education for pharmaceutical companies, drug manufacturers, wholesalers, pharmacists, which is dear to your heart, I'm sure, and practitioners. The third component is a community outreach where we partner up with affected communities and neighborhood coalitions to try to find some way for the community to fill the gap when drug organizations are taken out of their community so they don't crop back up. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was going to say that there's a lot of pieces that fall into those three components. And if you'd like, I can go through some of those and talk about that. And if you have questions, we can talk.
No, that would be wonderful. I think talking about those three specific areas and some of the components involved would be great, along with the goals of the program.
Sure. Like I said, with law enforcement, there are strategy that works in one place may not work in another. So we've partnered with our state and local partners as well as other federal partners to identify trends and drug trafficking organizations within the specific regions of the affected areas. And we work at trying to prosecute the most significant drug traffickers and taking advantage of penalties provided by the federal system to try to rid our communities of those problems. In addition, 360 relies heavily on an initiative called Project Thunder, which is our special operations division in Washington, D.C. We use deconfliction through their vast database to try to look at trends and look at trying to link local traffickers with larger drug trafficking organizations, which eventually link back to, cartel influences and violent gangs, things of that nature. that operate on a nationwide level. By targeting that link, we can project and identify the full spectrum of the criminal network that's operating from top to bottom. Because, you know, one of the things that we talk about when we work these operations locally is, you know, we can cut off the tentacles that are affecting the community. But when it comes down to it, unless we take the head off the snake per se, people just spill back in. So we look at trying to target, you know, all the way to the top of the organization. Working closely with state and local partners, federal partners, we try to set up state and local task forces that work side by side with us and identify the most significant threats and try to partner to devise and implement an investigation that target those problems that face our communities. The other part, the second part is, like I said, working with diversion, which is there's another component of DEA that most people don't know about, which is the regulatory side of pharmaceuticals, the licensing for doctors to prescribe those pharmaceuticals and things of that nature. And we try to look at opioid abuse and the link that it has to the progression into the use of heroin. 80% of new heroin users usually start their progression of using drugs at an opioid addiction level, whether that be, you know, hydrocodone, oxycodone, something like that. You know, the regulatory side, we have 1.6 million registrants across DEA's licensing preview, if you would say, that are, like I said, they are the manufacturers, the wholesalers, the prescribers, the people that dispense the controlled prescription drugs, things of that nature. And we look at trying to engage the registrant community and ask them to fight the opioid abuse as well as addiction by trying to self-regulate. And we try to make every effort to provide them with the tools and provide them with education as far as that. You know, we have a lot of prescription of drugs that are obtained from family and friends, including, you know, the medicine cabinets at home that you may not finish a prescription and leave 5-10 pills in a bottle. And we've looked, DEA has addressed this with a nationwide program called National Drug Take Back Initiative, where in local PDs, in sheriff's office, state police posts, things of that nature, we have two events a year where people are allowed to bring in their prescription drugs that are not being used or they just want to get rid of, and there's no questions asked. We take those and then you know, we'll destroy those in an environmentally friendly way look at making sure that those prescriptions are not diverted into the drug trafficking flow. Just in West Virginia last year, I believe that we picked up a total of over, I believe it was 9,000 pounds of prescription drugs that won't go either into the environment because, you know, people will flush them or throw them away, things of that nature, nor will they be diverted into, you know, people using them in a fashion that's not in a prescribed manner. Last stats I have, there were nationwide, I believe, close to 370 tons of unwanted and unused prescriptions from more than 5,200 locations across the nation. I believe that was last year. So, you know, with that also, we also identify and pursue doctors and their registrants operating outside the law. We have two tactical diversion squads here in West Virginia that look at doctors, pharmacists, things of that nature that are diverting pharmaceuticals into the drug trafficking flow. Whether that be a doctor who is operating outside of what a legitimate doctor would do. We find a lot of times doctors that are diverting this are basically just, you come see the doctor, you pay a cash amount, and he'll write you a prescription. You take that prescription down the road and fill that prescription. Of course, that causes a problem in itself. One, if this drug trafficker or the user goes to several doctors, you can imagine how many pills can get diverted into the system, and it's just a huge problem. Secondly, we look at pharmacists that maybe turning a blind eye. In a lot of instances, the pharmacist says, "Well, I've got a prescription here from a doctor that it's a legitimate prescription. I'm going to go ahead and fill it." Well, we try to educate the pharmacist that at the end of the day, he has an ethical responsibility, or he or she has an ethical responsibility to police the doctors in some respects. If they see a pattern that's seems like it's beyond what a normal doctor would write prescriptions for, they should notify the authorities or make some kind of inquiry with the Board of Pharmacy to try to identify these doctors that are rogue. We also look at trying to educate and talk to the wholesalers. That's a huge problem here in West Virginia that has recently been brought to light, and we're working very closely with our Office of Diversion and as well as the local authorities to try to identify and try to correct this problem. And it's something that it takes time. It's a huge money making industry for these pharmacy companies, and they want to do, most of them want to do the right thing, and there's a lot of rules and regulations that are in effect and are being finely tuned to make sure that that everybody's doing the right thing, if you want to get down on that level. And then the third prong, of course, like I said, is a community outreach. During a lot of instances, you have these enforcement operations that will come in and take a group of people out of the community. And like I said, there's a lot of times that if it's a local impact or something of that nature, that those people that were taken out, those positions are filled in by another group of traffickers. So we look to try to talk to our coalition partners and talk to the community, things of this nature that we're doing here tonight, and try to, give them the tools they need to be able to go into the community and say, hey, we're not going to allow this to happen again. A lot of times that these communities, they don't have the resources or they don't have the tools to be able to make a strong presence known, and we hope that there's a lot of coalitions here in West Virginia that are in a position to assist these communities, and we hope to augment some of their programs to allow that to happen. And that's a kind of a down and dirty of what DEA 360 is. We're working, trying to augment things that are already here. Working to coordinate with other law enforcement, both state, local, and federal, to try to disrupt these drug trafficking organizations, and then educating and policing the regulatory side and on the diversion aspect of things.
Yeah, and I think we've had some of those partners on our show over the last several episodes, one of those being Kanawha Communities That Care, and the University of Charleston's doing a lot to partner with that organization to get the message out to parents of school-age children about disposing of medications properly and making them aware of the National Drug Take-Back Day on April 29th and the medication disposal systems and sending some of those medication disposal systems home with the children to share with their parents. Can you talk about some of the other non-governmental agencies that are involved with DEA 360?
Sure. There's, we we've reached out and worked very closely with numerous, and I'd be remiss if I don't say that I probably won't be able to mention everybody that has been involved with this. I would like to point out, like you said, the Kanawha Community That Cares. Christy Justice's organization does a great job here in the Kanawha County area. We work with the Putnam County Coalition with Bill O'Dell over in, like I said, in Putnam County. And we work with Michelle Perdue, who runs the United Way River Cities area over in Huntington, as well as, those are just a few of our local partners that are key stakeholders. We work a lot with the West Virginia Army National Guard's anti-drug prevention group, things of that nature, as well as we have national partners, Community Anti-Drug Coalition of America, CATCA, the DEA Educational Foundation, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks. I've got a list here. I want to make sure I don't forget any of the national partners. The Boys and Girls Club, Boy Scouts of America, Girl Scouts of America, the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids, and the Young Marines are just a few of the national partners that we work with to try to make this a successful program.
And this is a relatively new program to the DEA, is that correct?
It is. Last year, there were four pilot cities that were launched: Louisville, Milwaukee, St. Louis, and Pittsburgh. Like you said, Pittsburgh being the first. And the program is still developing, as you've seen, you know, with our conversations and the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy's assistance. We're constantly looking at enhancing the program and giving these coalitions the assistance that they need, as well as trying to augment what they're already doing. We're already looking at doing, it's called the DEA Youth Advance Program, where we come into the schools and it's, you know, provide at-risk children in the elementary schools a drug message, as well as they provide them, and we try to reach the kids through this dance program that we'll be starting in the Tri-County area, hopefully later this month, and try to give them a good message and give them a drug-free message and a healthy lifestyle message is what we're trying to provide for them.
And can you talk about some of the success that you've had or seen in those four pilot cities?
Yes, we've seen a tremendous response to the program, and I think that, you know, if you're not going to see a true number for this immediately, just because it's so new and there's not stats that are usually available, you know, for the past year that takes time for them to catch up. But, you know, just a tremendous cooperation and tremendous amount of interest in the program, I think is one of the benchmarks that is a good way to gauge what we're doing. You know, the Louisville just had their summit, I think it was several months ago, and they had just, you know, there were hundreds of people there that, you know, everybody wants this initiative to succeed and augment what's already out there. And, you know, I think that I hope that you see, you know, a reduction in the number of people that are addicted to opioids and heroin, you know, and, you know, it's just going to take time. It's one of those things that, you know, if we influence one child, in my opinion, the program's a success, that they are educated enough to make the right decision when that opportunity faces them, to say, you know what, I'm going to walk away and not do drugs. I'm not going to make an unhealthy decision that's going to affect me for the rest of my life. So, you know, there's a lot of things that people will, you know, down the road say, well, you know, did it do this? Did it do that? And that's yet to be seen. But, you know, just the tremendous outpouring and the people that want to be involved in a grassroots effort to try to stem the abuse of, you know, opioids in this country, or in this, even in this, I mean, in this region and in the cities that that the DEA 360 strategy has launched in, has just been overwhelming. I didn't realize when I first got here that there were so many programs and coalitions that were already out there. I was lucky to meet several people at a Army National Guard event, Red Ribbon event back in the fall of last year, that, you know, just opened my eyes to what was out there and the infrastructure that was already in place that for West Virginia. And those coalitions, you know, reach out beyond the borders of West Virginia, because this is not a West Virginia problem. It's a national problem that we're going to have to try to, you know, to get a grip on that. You know, if we don't, I think we're going to be in for a long, long haul of developing addictions that are not going to stop with opioids.
So how were the pilot cities, and in particular Charleston, selected for the program?
Well, I think, you know, it's obvious, and most of the listeners probably know that the West Virginia, Ohio, Eastern Kentucky, or Southern Ohio, Eastern Kentucky is kind of the bullseye for opioid and heroin abuse. You know, the death rates are just off the charts. And the national focus of this problem descended right on top of Charleston and the West Virginia, like I said, West Virginia, Southern Ohio, and Eastern Kentucky area. And Charleston was chosen. That's, you know, just happened to be, that's where our office was. But, you know, we recognize that it's a statewide problem. And I don't want the listeners to think that we're focusing strictly on Charleston. This is a, like I said, a West Virginia problem. It's a Southern Ohio problem. It's an Eastern Kentucky problem. It's across the nation. You know, I think that when we started this, it was DEA Charleston, and that was one of the things that somebody came to me immediately and said, you know, we need to be able to get buy-in from everybody, and we immediately said, well, I tell you what, we're going to call it. It's Charleston to Huntington Tri-County area. And, you know, like I said earlier, it's a developing program, and if we had tried to roll this out completely statewide, you know, it would have been an overwhelming program to roll out. We're trying to include everybody in it, and I don't want anybody to be discouraged if they don't see us in their areas, but it is something that we're working with our Clarksburg office, with our Wheeling office, to try to, you know, try to work on this problem. And like I said, Charleston was chosen just because it was kind of that ground zero, the epicenter for the problem in the Tri-County area, and it was recognized that way by the upper management at DEA and D.C., as well as, you know, headquarters level, as well as my boss, Mr. Colder, in Washington, D.C.
Well, certainly a very difficult problem that we're facing in West Virginia, but also some of our listeners nationwide can probably relate. David, I want to thank you for joining us. I want you to hold on, because we are going to be likely have some questions, and I'm sure that there are some of those are going to be ones that only you can answer.
Hopefully, I'll be able to answer them.
I hope so.
Yep.
Yeah. You know more than I do, but we're going to put you on standby for just a moment, and just let everyone know who's listening that you're welcome to join our conversation, and you can do so by dialing 563-999-3780 and pressing the number 1. That lets us know that you have a question or comment in queue. And in addition, we're encouraging everyone to follow our discussion on Twitter at @anaturalbridge and at UCSOP. And speaking of the School of Pharmacy and issues related to drug diversion, the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy is wanting all of our listeners to help with medication adherence and safety by taking the pledge to take your medications as prescribed and disposing of your medications properly. You can take your pledge today by visiting www.ucwv.edu/pharmacy. And again, the number to call in this evening is 563-999-3780. I would like to transition here by inviting two very special ladies to join us. These two ladies are members of the University of Charleston class of 2018, so they will be graduating with their pharmacy degrees this time next year. And so I would very much like to welcome to the show Amy Bateman and Victoria Olawole. And I always mess up her name, even though I've practiced a million times. She's giggling at me as we're sitting here. But Victoria is our president of the Pharmacy Student Government Association, and she provides a lot of administrative guidance and structural support to that organization, as well as to our 19 professional student organizations here at the School of Pharmacy. She's dedicated to improving the health and wellness in underserved communities and tackling challenges faced in providing the best patient outcomes in pharmacy care. She holds a bachelor's degree from the University of Minnesota, so she knows a little bit more about snow than the rest of us. We're battling 70-degree weather here today. Life is rough. And then also she's joined by Amy Bateman, who is a third-year pharmacy student at the University of Charleston, and she's very engaged with our APHA chapter, in particular the Generation Rx program that we've talked about on previous episodes. Interestingly, Amy is not new to healthcare. She was a registered nurse for 10 years prior to beginning pharmacy school, and she lives in Seth, West Virginia, which is very rural part of West Virginia, with her husband and two children, Jack and Sarah. We have to give Jack and Sarah a shout out in case they're listening tonight. So I want to welcome Victoria and Amy to the show. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
So my first question actually is for Amy. Amy, if you can, you're a native of West Virginia. So if you can share your perspective on the pervasiveness of the opioid epidemic in the state, whether it's here in Charleston or the surrounding areas, what's your perspective? Can you share that with our listeners?
Well, I certainly feel like the opioid crisis, it's definitely reached a crisis level. And I think that all of us throughout the communities and the healthcare community and the law enforcement community, we need to realize that this is not an epidemic that is strictly in one subgroup of people. People of all economic statuses and everywhere throughout the state are affected by this epidemic. And it truly is a statewide and nationwide issue.
So in your time as a registered nurse prior to coming to pharmacy school, did you witness this problem in terms of treating patients?
Certainly. I spent 3 years in acute care prior to going into long-term care. Initially, 10 years ago when I started in acute care, we started seeing a lot of what we would term drug-seeking behavior or seeking behavior. So it's certainly a problem that is not new, but now we are cracking down on our prescription drug abuse, so we're leading into the heroin epidemic that we're seeing now in the area.
And so, Victoria, is there anything you'd like to add from your perspective as a student pharmacist? And I know that you've been out on your introductory practice experience rotations and been doing some volunteer work. And can you speak to some of the things that you've seen?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Amy did say. And also, it's different to see it on the news, and it's another experience to see it firsthand. So I think one thing that makes our program different is they really do train us with, you know, a lot of the drug diversion, you know, behaviors, trains us as pharmacists as far as what, you know, how do we respond to these situations and kind of understanding our place and our role within addressing a lot of these issues that we've been hearing about on previous episodes and also that we were talking about today as well.
How do you all think, and this is, you know, you may or may not be prepared for this question, but how do you think the opioid and heroin epidemic has changed the way we educate student pharmacists?
I think that really being active in the conversation is a crucial point. So it's really not a passive thing that we just know it exists. But, you know, if somebody walks into the pharmacy, if you do suspect something, we get first off the resources to know, okay, you know, who can I call or who can I, you know, go to as far as if this needs to be reported or do we need to get someone help. Also, too, I think another area is just really understanding how it originates, you know, how people get into the behavior, because it's easy to really kind of shame the abusers and whatnot. But as pharmacists, you know, our job is, you know, the patient and also any customers here in the retail setting. So really knowing how to communicate and interact with them is a big way that I think the program has prepared us in going out and serving as future pharmacists.
And I think as healthcare professionals, especially pharmacists, coming from a nursing background into the pharmacy school program, we understand the medications, we understand the mechanisms the medications has inside of the body, so it's a little easier to maybe answer some of those harder questions and understand where that comes from. And also here at the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy, we receive naloxone training, where we can eventually, as future pharmacists, offer that to our patients or patients' family members. They do instruction with us on how to administer the naloxone, and that's another service that we can offer once we do become pharmacists.
How do you all see your fellow student pharmacists and also pharmacy faculty, right, involved in the DEA 360 program?
Oh, I think we have a significant number of students and faculty that are involved in the DEA initiative. I know for myself, through Generation RX, we have a significant number of students who go out into the local grade schools. We went into 6 grade schools here in Kendall County and 3 grade schools in the Boone County area and tried to reach out to those children at that level for prevention purposes. And we've had 60 to 80 students involved, and also a significant number of faculty member involved in that also.
In addition to what Amy said, I think as well the Script Your Future campaign in general really helps with medication adherence, because sometimes these problems do start with, you know, taking a prescription medication, and sometimes the education provided with the risks associated with, you know, drug dependence and, you know, addiction for some as well, providing that for a patient is very useful and helpful. So that's been a way I know that student pharmacists have been able to get involved in the conversation. And of course, the pharmacy faculty that are here at the school really educating us and, you know, applying what they've experienced at their different settings as well as an important way for them to have gotten involved as well.
Do you all feel that healthcare providers, and in particular pharmacists, are good partners for this initiative?
Absolutely. Not only Victoria and I spoke to the understanding of the medications and the mechanism that they have inside of the body and how we truly understand the addiction, but not only that, pharmacists are very accessible to individuals, oftentimes more so than physicians. Like Dr. Garner spoke of before, I'm from a rural area, and we really only have 2 doctors in the area, so pharmacists can be that other person that individuals can go to get answers and to get help with treatment and a direction to guide them to treatment. Pharmacists are very accessible within the community.
Yeah, like Amy kind of mentioned, I think that, you know, we, with the accessibility, especially that area people see, you know, their pharmacists and speak with their pharmacists a lot more than their doctors many times, or, you know, their other healthcare providers. So we really have a space in, you know, advocating for the patient and also speaking to a lot of the issues that we may see within our different communities and whatnot. And I think the important part to realize in this initiative is that it can't be on one front. It's very collaborative. So not only on the pharmacy end or the DEA end, but, you know, doctors and the nurses and other people within the community, and really that outreach point is very crucial in this. So as much as we do have a big role, I think it's going to have the greatest impact when everyone is able to kind of work together in a concerted effort.
Susan, I totally agree with what she just said. They, you know, there's indications that we look at through record keeping that will flag doctors or pharmacies or things of that nature. But a lot of times they may not arise to that level where they get flagged. And like Victoria, I think it was Victoria, just said that, you know, there's a lot of need on the level of the medical provider as well as the pharmacist to, you know, to look at that and make sure that, you know, that they're aware of what's going on in their surroundings and see the you know, some of the factors that may contribute to, you know, improper care or diversion of pharmaceuticals and things of that nature.
David, I'm so glad you chimed in because we actually had a question come through that was directed to you.
Okay.
And so it goes something like this. Many years ago, a friend who was from a small town said that drugs are used because kids have nothing else to do. Do you find that this is the case? And if so, would having more real activists be a weapon against drug usage in those communities?
Yeah, I kind of live by the adage, what is it, idle hands type philosophy. But, you know, in my experiences and, you know, we find that a lot of times, you know, the child or the person that is has too much time on their hands or things of that nature, and there's not the outreach programs that are available, will, you know, turn to a I don't know what's the best way to put it, a lifestyle that's probably not the most healthy. And if we can try to, you know, reach out to these kids and give them an alternative, or reach out to the young adult and give them an alternative, I think that, you know, I think that there will be a lot of correct decisions made, and hopefully that, you know, when that time presents itself that they have to make a decision, they won't be in that position because they're out doing something that's constructive or you know, being able to find or identify with something that is beneficial to them instead of, you know, finding themselves in that position.
Yeah, and, you know, you've got two parents sitting here too, so I think we probably agree with a lot of that as well. I know Amy and I both keep our kids very, very busy. So.
Yeah, exactly. I've got children of my own, and that's, you know, it's one of my concerns, you know, moving here, not them not being from here. I find that, you know, it's a hard community to break into because most everybody is from here. So
yeah, everybody knows, you know, everybody.
Yeah, exactly. So the new kid on the block usually gets, you know, it takes a while for them to get into that, into a group. So, you know, I always worry about that. Is, you know, is there too much time that they have on their hands to make a bad decision? Where I think someone that's you know, busy and active, you know, sometimes will not have that problem. So, you know, hopefully there we can find, you know, activities for these people or for the youth and the young adults. Even, I mean, there's it stems to, I say you know, children and young adults. It spans a large age group that the problem is in, and hopefully that there's outreaches there that they can tie into to find the right path to go down, like I like to say. So
we've got a couple more questions that have come in for you, David, and I think this is a very interesting one, because when people hear DEA, they automatically associate it with law enforcement. I mean, DEA has the word enforcement in it. So the mm-hmm. question is, how challenging is it to go from an enforcement perspective to a prevention and outreach perspective?
I think you and I have talked about this, Dr. Gardner. Yeah. This whole thing is kind of new to me, and I've spent, you know, the last 20 years of my career in an enforcement capacity. So when the 360 initiative came along, it's a completely new animal to me. And but I found it that it's been very challenging. I'm very much have bought into the program. The DEA 360 initiative makes perfect sense. I mean, we can enforce ourselves all day long, but at the end of the day, you can't enforce yourself out of a problem. We've got to be able to educate people. We've got to be able to reach out to the industry professionals and ask for their assistance and make them aware of problems that we see. And we've got to be able to support these grassroots community efforts to say, hey, you know, we're here to support your program. We're here to promote your program. You know, what can we do to help? With upcoming events, like I said, we've got the dance program. We're going to have a summit to talk about the problem and try to identify solutions to the problem and get those solutions implemented. Mr. Colder, my boss, is 110%. I know everybody says there's only 100%, but he's so dedicated to this problem that I talk to him weekly about it. And he wants this to succeed in Charleston, through Huntington, and in the West Virginia area. And community outreach, I think, is one of the biggest things that we can do to try to educate the community with events that give the public an avenue to become educated and find things out there that can help them if they have a problem or if they just want more information on the problem to try to affect where they live in their community or their community.
Yeah, most definitely. I think we've definitely it takes a village, as we've said, and it's definitely a community effort, and everyone
exactly.
has to own the problem. So
exactly,
no one's in it alone. This next question is for Victoria and Amy, and that's the question is, how can pharmacists balance the trust of their customers, patients, but also serve as the first line of defense in preventing drug abuse or overprescriptions provided by doctors? How do you balance that? It's like an exam question, right?
I think that as healthcare professionals and individuals that someone in the community may look up to, I think that we have to be honest and upfront with our patients and be consistent with our practices. Don't fill a prescription this time and then maybe not fill it next time. And I think we need to be consistent with our providers, communicate with our providers, provide them with feedback, and have a good communication line with the providers and with the patients, and be open and honest with all of our dealings. That way the patient knows what to expect, the provider knows what to expect, and just be consistent with our practices, taking both perspectives into account.
Yeah, I think that as well with the consistency, also with, your message and, establishing when you have that trust, they know they can come to you if they do need something or if they need clarifications on, proper use. Because one thing that, a lot of people may not know is pharmacists actually trained, and we are trained here at the School of Pharmacy in the drug diversion, area. We have, classes and whatnot. So I think that while, you know, you have your, you know, ethical and moral duty, really having that communication and, you know, consistency in your message to the patient as well is a way that you can manage both. There are times when you do have hard situations. You know, there's no cookie cutter example or answer that you're going to be able to give every single time. But with the tools that we do have and as we're prepared now, I think that, you know, we will be able to handle those situations in a way that it, we're still able to, you know, fulfill our duties to both our profession and also to the patient as well.
So you're listening live to Parent Talk, live special edition, Safe Medication Use. We're talking about the DEA 360 program. We have about 10 minutes left of our show, so if you have questions for any of our guests, you can dial in at 563-999-3780 and press the number 1. That lets us know that you have a question or comment in queue. This question could probably go to any of the three of you, and you may each have a different opinion, but how misinformed or uninformed are doctors as it relates to their role in preventing drug abuse? That may be a very loaded question, but... who wants to take a stab at that?
Well, I mean, I don't want to say the word misinformed per se, because I think each, you know, situation is different. Every doctor is different, what they know, what they don't know. So I don't want to generalize and say, you know, call it misinformation. But I think that as, you know, the field of healthcare is evolving, we're seeing more and more of a place for the pharmacist. So in combating maybe what's perceived as misinformation or not really knowing, the pharmacist is kind of there to, you know, fill in the holes. Or sometimes things have been done this way because that's how it's been done. There's really, you know, no evidence to back it up. So pharmacists can kind of clarify a lot of those, you know, problematic situations that may have gotten us or may have had a hand in getting us into this epidemic or crisis, as you'll have it. So I'm not going to speak too much on doctors being misinformed because I think that's a generalized statement, but more so as from the pharmacy end of things, we are able to, you know, clarify and provide, you know, more information to kind of guide and help prescribing and, you know, identify areas in which, you know, prescribing can kind of lead to ways of forms of drug diversion and writing unnecessary prescriptions.
And I feel like that physicians in general, they providers in general, it was never a misinformation or an intentional thing. It was to help the patient. And I think we did stuff without the foresight, maybe. Mm-hmm. And our patient came to us and said, you know, we have this pain, and the doctor gives you this prescription, and then you take the prescription, then you have like 4 or 5 left, and then someone finds it in the cabinet, and, you know, it kind of snowballs out of control. From that perspective, I don't necessarily think it was a misinformation as much as we didn't foresee that it was going to become the epidemic and eventually lead into the heroin epidemic that we're seeing now. We didn't foresee that. It's just something that couldn't be foreseen. But like Victoria spoke to, we can't generalize all physicians. Mm-hmm. There are some physicians who do it solely for the profit. Mm-hmm. And you know, unfortunately, the best that we can do is work with David and try to get those practitioners, you know, try to get those out of the equation and then combat this drug epidemic from a scientific.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I think the majority of the doctors out there are doing the right thing. You have a handful that do look at the money side of it. I think that you have a lot of doctors that, you know, maybe are, I don't know what the best way to say it is, you know, let's make sure that you're following, you know, some type of, you know, rehab protocol or something of that nature before we start, you know, dosing these larger amount and more potent drugs. because, you know, it's once you start down that path, it's hard to come back. And I think most doctors, they recognize the problem, and it's just one of these that, you know, at some point that we need to, you know, make sure they're fully educated, both practitioners on the medical side, you know, the pharmacists, things of that nature. And I think the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy is doing a great job trying to educate their students. And I know that my office, our diversion side, has been in and has spoken to several of your classes, and we really appreciate the effort you guys are making.
And to kind of
go ahead,
of piggyback off of all the points that have been raised, I think, too, starting at when we say misinformation, you know, understanding that all healthcare professionals are trying to do the best thing for the patient, or that's what, you know, we go into the profession for. So even the understanding of pain, something that's very subjective, we're learning more and more about it. So, you know, at one time it could be we want to get someone's pain to a zero. You know, for example, with something like back pain, some people's back pain will never get to a zero. So really understanding kind of how we can, you know, use drugs, like medications, and also, you know, other lifestyle modifications as well, is a big area that I think everyone is learning about, and knowing how to treat pain, something that is so, that can be seen as very subjective, treated with, you know, medicines, because everyone's perceptions can be different. I think that's another important area in understanding this whole epidemic. A lot of times the intentions are very good, and it has unforeseen, you know, consequences, as Amy said before.
I think we have time for one more question, and this one's kind of tough, but I'm thinking that Amy and Victoria in particular are up to the challenge. I warned them that callers have very difficult questions, and so this is good training for them. This is very good training. So the question is, are doctors paid based on the number of prescriptions they issue? And the person who typed this actually asked because they informed their doctor that they did not take the medication for the pain, but the doctor prescribed it again anyway, and this was oxycodone in the interest of full disclosure. And so now the patient has 60 tablets, which seems like a lot to me, but I'm not a pharmacist, 60 tablets of medication he or she did not need, want, or use. Lots of issues to address there, so where do you want to start?
No, physicians are not paid on the number of prescriptions that they write, to answer the first part of your question. Yes, 60 Oxycontin tablets is quite a few, or oxycodone tablets is quite a few tablets to be hanging out in your medicine cabinet. But once again, that's why we want to emphasize the safe disposal of these medications. Those 60 tablets, if we safely dispose of those and don't harm the environment, that's 60 tablets that someone else may not get a hold of, and may not lead to a more systemic problem. But no, physicians are not paid by the number of prescriptions that they write.
And let me ask as a follow-up to that. So I'm a patient, and I get a prescription for pain medicine. Am I then obligated to go fill that prescription?
No, ma'am. You're not obligated to fill any prescription. It's still your choice as a patient to choose which treatment that you'll receive.
And I think this is where, you know, it stresses the point of this whole initiative happening on all different levels. It's just not, you know, the health professional side or the DEA side. Also, the community outreach is a big thing. So, you know, I've seen patients, I'm sure Amy has too, that as they get a prescription, there's questions or concerning whether they need it or not. You know, as the patient, you too also have the power to, you know, to, you know, ask your provider, okay, why do I need this? Or if you're not comfortable if having a controlled substance for your pain control, there are other options you can use. So on the patient's end as well, you can also, you know, have that conversation and kind of open that dialogue with the provider, because I think everyone has something that they can learn on all ends, even if it's patient to doctor, doctor to patient, pharmacy to any other area. So it's not just one-sided as far as the communication trail and who can, you know, kind of expand their perspective and learn more about the issue.
This is another great question, and it's probably going to have to be one of our final ones. And I'm sorry, David, I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you have something to add before we go to the final question?
I did. I just wanted to reiterate a little bit about the National Drug Takeback Program. For that listener, if you've got medication that you don't want, check with your local police department or check with the local DEA office, and we can direct you where to go drop that prescription off to dispose of it properly. April the 29th is the next National Drug Takeback Initiative Day, and if you've got medication that you want to get taken care of, go on our website, DEA.gov, and it will point you to a local police department or sheriff's office or state police location to drop those medications off.
That's an excellent point, just very excellent point. We also talked last week about medication disposal bags that you can purchase at your pharmacy for a nominal fee, and you can dispose in some cases up to 45 pills. It will dissolve those, deactivate them, and then it's safe to then throw that bag in the trash once the medication is deactivated. Final question for tonight, and this is important because I think it speaks to how the role of the pharmacist is changing, but the listener wants to know, how can pharmacists really work with the patients, because you've got so many people coming into the pharmacy, very high volume. Sometimes it's not very private. So how can I have those kinds of conversations with my pharmacist if I have questions about my medication, or if I should fill a prescription, or is this the right medication for me? How do I go about having that conversation in a more private environment with my pharmacist?
I think especially in the retail setting, it can be from a patient or customer point of view, sometimes it's very intimidating to go at the very busy times when you see someone's busy. And, you know, it's happened to me. I've gone to pick up a prescription, and if someone looks busy, I'm not trying to have a thorough life conversation, which is understandable. But I think definitely knowing, if you do call in and ask maybe when the less busier times are, that's one way to, you know, kind of address that, and also to ask if the pharmacy has, you know, programs, or maybe someone in particular that does, you can make an appointment and kind of discuss your medications and, you know, go through any concerns or questions you may have. That off the top of my head, that'd be what I would suggest as far as for those very busy, you know, retail settings that a lot of us are accustomed to seeing.
And also, I would like to add that all pharmacies should have consultation rooms. So certainly if you would get a prescription and have a question about it, whether it be a controlled substance or not, ask the pharmacist if you could step into a consultation room. It's a private area that you could ask questions to the pharmacist about the medication. And this could be any medication. It's important to be informed about all medications that you're taking, not just narcotic medications.
Excellent, excellent point. Well, unfortunately, we are running out of time, and we could probably talk about this issue for a whole nother hour. And so we hope you'll join us next week for our sixth and final episode of Parent Talk Live Special Edition. Next week, we'll be talking with some of our pharmacists who are here on faculty at the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy about disease management and medication adherence. And we'll be focusing on three specific disease states: cardiovascular, diabetes, as well as respiratory health. Thank you for listening to Parent Talk Live Special Edition, and please don't forget to go online and take the pledge to take your medications as prescribed. You can visit the site today at www.ucwv.edu/pharmacy. Thanks for listening, and have a wonderful evening. Thank you.